Hello, friends. It's another episode of Sacktown Talks by the Nooner. This week, we sit down with John Laird, a former California Assembly member and the Secretary of the Natural Resources Agency for 8 years under the Brown administration. John Laird is also just a general California political veteran, and along with his colleague Mark Leno, was the first openly gay man to serve in the California legislature. We join the conversation as he shares his perspectives on why LGBT women ascended to power first. A quick note, we've been having some technical difficulties and they continued for this week's episode. We unfortunately failed to capture the first 20 minutes of our talk. I think I speak for everyone involved when I say that we got the best part of the conversation on record. For our listeners, this should be the last of the technical issues for a while. We've created appropriate redundancies and have troubleshooted to keep these issues from popping up again in the future. Thanks again for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
You came in with Mark. I'd love to hear what that was like. And also, if you have any feelings as to what Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana, 37-year-old, openly gay in Indiana, Mike Pence territory, and veteran. You know, what his candidacy, not if you're supporting it or not, but what that means to you as an openly gay man.
Well, talking about some of those things briefly in sequence, I mean, one of the interesting things is every one of those women, and there's a great movie about the first four of them, were
Sheila Kuehl,
Chris Kehoe, Jackie Goldberg, and Carol Migdon. Yep. Each one was really strong in their own right, had a different path, but a strong path to get there. And I was always proud of them and enjoyed serving with them. There was just one nuance, because people would always say to me, how did they beat the men? And I have to say that one of the factors is that the HIV epidemic really wiped out a lot of the men that might have been the first ones. Bill Krause in San Francisco. Neil Good wasn't HIV, but succumbed to something in San Diego. There was Frank Cook in Long Beach. There were all these men that might have tied them coming in, and I think that was a little bit of a factor. And so for Mark and I to make it there at the same time, and while I consider him a brother because we went through it, we had distinctly different paths. And I teased him once because I think the recall was failed of Gray Davis in San Francisco, I don't know, 80-20 or something. And I said, so your call for courage is much easier coming from that situation. Oh,
and now you're running for the state Senate that is being led by not only the first woman, but an openly gay woman.
Yes. This is, you see, when I had my 15 minutes of fame in 1983, there were three of us that were the first openly gay mayors in the country that were all in that year. And there were probably 10 or 12 openly gay elected officials in the country at the time. And you were truly swimming upstream. People say, oh, it was Santa Cruz. And I'm like, didn't make it any easier. Didn't stop the full-page ad when I was running for re-election the Sunday before the election. Didn't stop a rather demented death threat and a few other things. And at the time, I knew I was right. But I was never sure I was on the right side of history. And I got an award at the Obama White House in, I think it was 2013. They had Harvey Milk Champions of Change. And I thought, okay, that turned out to have been the right side of history, although Mike Pence might be challenging that a little bit. and so there was a summit here last week by Equality California, and there had to be 125 or 150 out LGBT officials from across California. And I was even blown away by it. I mean, in the Monterey Bay, there's a new council member in Carmel and one in Monterey, a new woman in Santa Cruz, somebody that's a school board member in Watsonville. Around the Monterey Bay, people just moved into elected office in this last cycle. And while there are lots of people over lots of cycles in California, that seems to be happening in really uncharacteristic places.
At what point is it no longer like a hindrance?
And I think it's close to, in some places, not being a hindrance.
I mean,
but the question is, the one that I get all the time is, well, why is there still an issue? There's marriage, there's all these things. but there's still a higher homelessness in kids because they're kicked out and things are white. There's still a higher level of bullying that goes on. Trans people have challenges at every way. There are some people that would like to undo marriage, even though that seems relatively secure. It is really sort of consolidating the changes that are really evident.
Yeah, you know, In my mind, I think probably the most enduring gift of the LGBT movement for the rest of America will be the liberalization of our sexual values away from sort of like the old puritanical norms. And I welcome that. I just want to say that. But, you know, I think that at some point, especially in some parts of California, you know, being gay is probably no longer the hindrance that it used to be. Certainly being gay and a woman of color, or being gay and you kind of add another layer of intersectionality around it, it can certainly be an issue. But I can just tell you, around some certain social circles here, just in Sacramento, it's seen as very chic to have at least one gay friend in your,
right,
in your,
but
you know. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. I'm just making the comment, right?
Oh, no, but, I get it. And yeah. I wasn't. My off-camera eye roll was just whatever it was.
Yeah, and we're still at a point where a brilliant gay Republican businessman from many parts of the state is not welcome, will not get out of a primary. And so there still is issue.
Well,
the only one.
Some enclaves will never change.
I mean, right? We have Carl DeMaio, and he's the most prominent elected or formerly elected gay Republican in California. And he's made himself somewhat persona non grata. He's trying to recall Gavin Newsom.
He's
right
also
now.
Just a dickhead.
How do you really feel, Javon?
I
think the thing is there are, you know, there was the mayor of Turlock, who just lost re-election and came close, was out and maintained conservative Republican endorsements. I think it was factors that were unrelated to that really contributed to it. And there are people around the state. It sort of blows me away that I'm getting Republican endorsements in my Senate race, because I think when I first went into the assembly, just the fact that I was gay would have prohibited that from happening. Yeah. And I just don't think that's a factor in the same way.
But yeah, it's important to note that John did previously run for Senate and lost against Republican Sam Blakesley, who's frankly a generally good guy. Another, I think, community college. Was he a?
Yes, he was on the Cuesta College board
member. And, you know, a generally good guy, but it was a special election, if I remember correctly. So it's not a given as if all the Republicans are running against John on the Central Coast. It's not, doesn't just come
well, if
easy.
I can say now that it's a podcast, the only regret I have from that race, because we ran a strong race, we held them to between 3 and 4 points. They called it on August 17th because they knew that was low turnout. I think I would have won a November consolidated election, but we couldn't do it. My only regret is one thing I didn't say. I censored myself in a debate. They gave us a half hour on the NBC local affiliate to debate. It was right after a court decision on marriage equality, and Sam wouldn't tell the anchor his position. And the anchor finally said, "What is it?" And Sam said, "I'm for traditional marriage." And that's when I censored myself, because I wanted to say, which of your marriages was most traditional, the first, the second, or the third, to just point out what I think is the hypocrisy in that kind of stuff. And I didn't do it, and my campaign people said that was wise, and I regretted it from that moment forward.
There have been a lot of similar jokes about the White House this week in a similar vein. Which of your wives have you not had a stand-in for?
This is what I'm like, kind of, that's what I'm talking about, though, right? Like, you know, like the Clintons probably too, you know, you can say many things about them. They're probably not monogamous. Okay. And I think we've kind of all just been like, yeah, okay, cool. You know, move on, you know? Whereas even just in the 1990s, we're like, oh, what? They're not monogamous. What the heck?
Well,
you
know, the interesting thing there,
and now we
is
have a president who's not monogamous,
but
and
they
no
got penalized for the fact that despite strange things might have happened, they decided to work it out and stay together, as opposed to the current person that's in his third because he could never work it out. You know, never decided that was important enough to do. So it always amazes me, without being agnostic on the facts of certain situations there about the attacks that come both ways.
Let me ask you, we've talked a little bit about sort of like changing cultural norms and what's accepted and not accepted. The guy in the guy from Bakersfield who got recalled, Roy Ashburn. Yes. Would that happen today? Wait, for folks listening, so he was
he lost a race coming back.
Right. And but I mean, he got eviscerated for it, right?
Well, yes, he was a county supervisor, an assembly member, a senator.
Let's just tell folks what happened, right?
So he came out. He didn't come out voluntarily.
Yeah.
He had a DUI with somebody else in the car. Then he decided to be really clear. And then he ran for the Board of Supervisors after that happened. And that's when he got eviscerated. And he had held that Board of Supervisors seat at one point in his past.
Right.
And the thing about it is it may happen now because it's Bakersfield. And the only reason I say that is that if you look at the 53 congressional races last November, the Republicans only held 7 of the 53. And nobody got over 60% of the vote in any of them except Kevin McCarthy, who got 68% in Bakersfield. And so I think that is still a bedrock place, unrelated to the fact that the Moores have probably changed in a significant number of places that might be considered traditional Republican across the state.
You can get a Democrat out of an assembly district in Bakersfield if it's drawn just downtown. And that's usually what, you know, the smart thing
Rudy
is done.
Rudy Salas.
So Rudy Salas. But once you draw something as big as a soup district or a congressional district or a state senate district, you've got to take in more.
You've got to take in some fire and brimstone types.
Right. And so the way that the current
you've got to reach out to Hank Williams Boulevard.
Yeah, you just drew the arc into the district.
Right. And so now you have an east-west situation, and the Democrats just won the west, which is Melissa Hurtado in Senate District 14.
And T.J. Cox having part of that area in the congressional.
And this gets into oil politics. We'll have to hold for a week because, you know, this is where it gets really ugly once we start talking oil and gas severance for some Democrats that it's a big part of the economy down there.
Well, you presumably have some thoughts on oil politics, having, you know, chaired natural, having been
it's
secretary
not just
for natural
that.
Resources.
I mean, yeah, when I was secretary.
And then off the coast of Santa Cruz as well, right?
In the 80s, I was one of the leaders against oil drilling off the coast. And one of those stories that ended up, I was interviewed on NPR and told the story at the height of Trump and Zinke proposing offshore oil drilling. And I was running for re-election to the city council in Santa Cruz, if you can believe it, 1985. And we had these off-year elections. And so they were low turnout elections. And so we always had ballot measures on with us to help boost the turnout. And so I went to Enviros and said, I would like to run an anti-offshore oil ballot measure. And they said, well, we only want to do it if there's teeth. And it's sort of like, well, we're a city. What kind of teeth could there be? So we came up with this formulation that you couldn't have a zoning change for onshore support facilities for oil drilling without a vote of the people. Because thing the Constitution granted,
zoning. Yeah.
And so,
which we would all say is awful right now.
Yeah. Well, that passed with 80% of the vote. But we had a little thing written in it saying, and you can use city money to educate other cities and counties on if they might want to consider to do the same thing.
Oh my goodness, so, that's too far, John.
So by the time 5 years later passed. I think 26 counties and cities adopted those ordinances on the coast. We were sued by the oil companies after 13. We beat them in federal court because it wasn't an outright ban, and it was within the local constitutional powers. And almost every single one of those ordinances is still on the books now in case it comes up here. So if you ask if I might have been involved in anti-offshore oil drilling, I was.
Go ahead. No,
I'd like to
– fire and water.
We talked fire and water, and, you know, the listeners know, I mean, we've talked about water and the tunnels, whatever, one or two before. And, you know, but I wanted to touch bases in particular regarding the Central Coast and its impact, because everybody thinks about water politics as being the North-South, as to how do you ferry water from Northern California to Southern California, including the Central Valley farms, or the opposite? How do you keep that water up here? How do you flush the delta, which water flowing out to the sea, Dad, is a good thing. I just talked to my dad the other day. We're going to let all this water flow out to the sea. Well, that's actually a very good thing for the environment. And you've been on both sides on that. But, you know, I was at Farmers Market on Sunday, and I was talking to a representative of a farm in Capay Valley. And I understand you have family up there, and they're concerned about their access to water and saying, everybody's talking about water, but nobody's talking about us. Now, their Capay Valley is... their water is fed from Cache Creek, which comes out of Lake Berryessa. So they're not part of the State Water Project, or the Federal Central Valley Project. So there's a water issue that affects local family farms. This would include the wine country that we saw in Sideways, which I believe is in SD 17 as well. What do you see from your perspective coming out of natural resources where it was the big water issues? Do you see some of these micro water issues in particular affecting Senate District 17 is also where your family is up in the Capay Valley or the foothills above Sacramento?
Absolutely. And the real issue is that I can't recall the precise percentage, but maybe 30% of Californians do not get water in any way related to the Delta. And as a result, it's really true where I'm running. The district runs from southern San Jose to the San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara County line. Santa Cruz and Monterey counties do not import water. They do not import a drop of water. They have to live on whatever they can generate there. And there's one particular problem going on, which is the Carmel River has been so overdrafted in Monterey County that for 20 years, the state board has said you have to reduce by 2/3 the amount you take from there, and they have to have an alternate supply in place that they've never quite been able to agree on. They're close on a desal plant now. And in Santa Cruz, it is on the edge. It's just on the edge. If our reservoir doesn't fill, we have restrictions. If that drought had gone on another year or two, Santa Cruz has 95% surface water, there was a chance that the reservoir would go dry. So when you take that and the Capay Valley and then try to project it onto state politics, the water bonds always have to have something in them for the places that are not in these massive hydraulic water transfer water projects, whether it's because desalting is controversial. Not resolved in some places, the controversy, but
is it resolved anywhere?
Yes, it's resolved in San Diego and Orange County, where they have industrial size ones. But you see, the key thing is
resolved as in they were put in there, but people are still pissed off, right?
Not the way they're pissed off in other places.
Okay,
and I think one of the issues is that they have so many customers that that's the most expensive alternative. And you can bury it in rates for other water so that it doesn't, it's not off the.
And in Orange County, you also had industrial areas already beachfront, essentially.
Yes.
So that's kind of the fight in other areas is actually carving out.
And you also have the problem in Orange County that they were so overdrafting that the seawater was intruding. And it's what's going on in parts of Santa Cruz and Monterey County. And you have to have an alternate source to stem the seawater intrusion and to cover for the sources that used to be supplied by wells that now are contaminated by the seawater intrusion. So it's a crazy issue. And in Orange County, they use recycling together with desalting, and they recycle the water, and then they recharge it in the area to push back against the salt. And so it's all these issues going together, and in the bigger places, you can afford that. In the smaller places, you face some of these huge problems, and you don't have the rate base, and you don't have the state assistance to help you at the level that other places are helped.
You know, I don't want to take us on a big, long tangent here, because we've got a lot to discuss here, but you know, for the it always amazed me when I heard like the environmentalists were so against desal. You know, and like when I think about, you know, we have this talking point in the legislature, California leads the way. California is the way of the future. We have the most progressive policies, and we figure it out for the rest to the benefit of the rest of the world. Isn't desal one of these things? I mean, if we're able to figure out how to really implement this technology in a sustainable way here, Can't that be a great benefit to the rest of the world? I mean, isn't this almost like the holy grail?
It is.
Why not try and figure it out here?
Because, well, we are going to try to figure it out, but you just said if it can be figured out. And the if is sort of on two sides. One is can you take the water from somewhere that it's not sucking in marine life and being part of the problem?
Right. We're talking right around Monterey Bay Aquarium.
I grew up in Pacific Beach and LA.
And then the second half is the whole process is about removing brine from the water. What do you do with the brine?
It's like nuclear waste.
Yeah, do you do? There are certain ways. There might be certain pools that can be evaporation and it works. If you have sewer outfalls, which over time will probably be a challenging thing to maintain, you can put the brine in with the treated water at the same percent that it was pulled out, and you can return the salt. Hmm. But then that does two things. It means you can't recycle water if you need it to dispose of the brine.
Right.
And we're finding in some of the scientific studies on ocean acidification that while the overwhelming thing is the carbon content that the oceans are holding, and that's the root of acidification, there's minor contributions from nitrates, from agricultural runoff, and from sewer outfalls. And so if you institutionalize the need for a sewer outfall to dispose the brine, over time, that might not be there. And so these are the challenges that, you know, there's a question about, can you take water in from underground to desalinate in a way that you're not threatening the fish species? That's been some of the test work that was sort of required by the Coastal Commission in one of these plants. And then there are different ways to look at disposing of the brine. But those are still real issues. And until we have so much renewable power that maybe the price comes down, this is the most expensive alternative. And so that is a challenge in particularly disadvantaged communities. They're not going to be able to afford this without some kind of subsidy.
We talked about, you know, some of these locations like Cape Valley, the Central Coast, and people may be going, oh, that's not my area. But if you live in Sacramento and you're eating local produce, if you're shopping at a farmer's market, if you live in San Jose, if you live in Santa Cruz, if you live in San Francisco, most of those farmers market is Cape Valley. I mean, basically all of Northern California in particular, the urban areas that are looking for relatively local produce, it is from these areas that we have this water concern and we also have a fire concern. So where are we at in wildfire preparedness and response as you recently left as secretary?
We're behind, and we're behind because the climate has changed and because all our assumptions are based on a climate that doesn't exist anymore. And so just 2 years ago, we changed the fire funding for the state because it was based on a fire season that no longer existed. The fire season starts a month earlier and goes a month longer than a generation ago. And
tell
that's
me when
if it stops at all.
Are you telling me when the legislature voted on the SB 930 bill on PG&E on August 31st in 2017, you're saying that wasn't the end of fire season? Because that's what I heard the last night of session. Oh, wait, 2 months later, 2 days before, 2 days after the November election, we had the
In defense of the legislature, they'd clearly been locked up in the chambers for a while.
Right. And I meant 2018. 2017 was the other fires. But
well, I think the real thing is that what happened in Paradise, what happened in Santa Rosa, what happened in Redding is more about the future than the past. And we're going to see it again. And we can almost predict where the prime places are in California where that could happen. The Highway 49 corridor, some of the coastal hills and ranges, some of the Southern California, almost anywhere in San Diego outside the main urban area, some of the desert hills in Southern California. And so the question is what can we do and what will we do? And the previous governor doubled the amount of prescribed fire, forced treatment, tried to move it into private grants, tried to do cap and trade money for it. All good.
We didn't rake.
No, we didn't rake.
Wait, let me stop on the raking here. I mean, okay, yeah, you know, Trump is not the most erudite or eloquent guy, but is there something to be said for, you know, there's something we're leaving behind in our forestry management that could make us more resistant to fire?
Yes. Yes, except for I can talk freer now. We were really trying to cooperate in the interest of everything when I was secretary, but some of these fires come out of federal force, and we spent almost half of our cap and trade money cleaning up federal force because the federal government wasn't doing it.
I want to say it's like 80%. Like 80% were federal lands, I think, of one federal.
So are they not doing the raking?
Yes. No. The thing about it is the overwhelming majority of forest lands in California are in federal jurisdiction.
Okay.
And the real thing that happened was is that we've been going back and forth on like who is properly funded or not funded. They had sequestration. But the real issue is they just couldn't deal with the federal budget. And so they just cannibalized anything else to fight fires. And so treatment afterwards, prevention before, that was all cut because they didn't have enough money to fight the fires. And they finally have appropriated it differently starting September of the end of this budget year, beginning of next budget year at the federal. So it's, I guess it's October 1st. They're finally not going to cannibalize some of the forest preparation and forest treatment afterwards to fight the fires. And we had these things called good neighbor agreements where we had the right to go on federal lands if there was a crisis or some treatment where we had the money. And we've been doing that, which was the irony in the attack coming from the federal government about California isn't doing enough. I mean, the only way I'd say that is we're not doing their job enough. It would be the only way that's a true statement.
So I am I'm randomly friends with a bunch of ranchers up north, Stony Ford, Chico, Orville. Mostly Stony Ford, kind of that area. And sort of the talking point that I keep hearing from my jujitsu buddies that are kind of live in the rural north and come down into town for jujitsu and are maybe kind of rural agrarian types is that the state of California makes it too difficult to clear out deadwood. And, you know, I mean, it's hard for me to evaluate because I don't know anything about forestry.
There's a certain element of truth to that.
Yeah.
But it's like you say, yeah, but you say the state of California as if we're this wonderfully generic thing of billions, tens of billions of dollars of budget. The real issue is this. The laws for permits were such that you had to do environmental review. And so, and it's an interesting story with Paradise. They were just on the verge of doing their whole next years of projects at the time of the fire. And they printed the notices to go out to every landowner. Do you want to be included for the environmental work and grants? They printed those notices a day or two before the fire, and they were to be picked up the morning of the fire. And somebody saved them by putting them in a car in the parking lot. So while the print shop burnt down, these notices were saved. And what we were trying to do is, as a state, do a statewide environmental impact report, which is really hard because you're covering all the acreage of the entire state. And that is scheduled to be done in May to make it easier for individuals in individual areas and fire safe councils to do that kind of work.
And so the permit would be to clear out deadwood in your own land or to clear out fire liabilities in your land? Or
in general, yes, without a more complex explanation, yes. And in some places, when you clear, it's a systematic fire break or systematic defensible space area. And there was one, we went out to see one by Lake Paradise that was very interesting. It was done by a private forestry company, and it worked in reverse. They were trying to protect one side, and it turns out it protected it coming from the other side in the fire. And it was a story on how that could, in fact, work. But it's been a bone of contention for years. When I was in the legislature, people didn't feel like they could do logging, so they wanted to do defensible space that might be a half a mile to allow for cutting. And that's been the underlying thing, is the forestry issues overlaying with the preparation. Now, there's been such a defense against fire and such fire suppression that there's just excess fuel across the state. And the response is not clear cutting, and the response is not excessive cutting. It is probably some measure of thinning. The question is how to do it in the right way. And I think the Chronicle or the New York Times in the last two or three days had a great series of graphics on how it's done, how it's right. And And it gets caught up in all the other forestry issues, but I think we're at a unique moment where we have the public's attention.
Well, and we were talking about this off mic before we started recording. Some of this is related to climate change, that fire behavior has also changed. And so some of our conventional knowledge, expectations about fire always running uphill, east to west or west to east in various circumstances, offshore winds, onshore winds, that's what we were seeing last year, was this shift where everything was being prepared. You marshal all the resources in a canyon, and then things go completely unexpectedly. And so what some of the reading I've done is that the actual fire behavior has changed in many cases. Is that
That's correct. And if you look at Redding having a fire tornado that was unprecedented with the conditions. And the thing about that's interesting, given what you just said about Paradise, is they had a fire 10 years ago. It scared them. They actually practiced evacuating with all the routes heading one way out of town. And they thought there would be time. And so they were going to evacuate in zones. The Paradise fire moved at 60 acres a minute.
Oh, my God.
60 acres a minute. And as a result, there was the word to evacuate the whole town when they finally figured out this was happening, and then it was gridlock, and it was impossible to do. And there was one particular instance. I was up there a number of times after the fire, and I was with the Cal Fire chief once. And there's this one in a commercial area somewhere in the middle of town, not where the downtown was. And there was a Safeway that burned to the ground and stripped commercials. And there was this one drugstore that was standing. And I was like, what's that about? And he said, well, it's really interesting. It's like people were trapped here. And so there were three fire engines trapped here. So they decided to defend that drugstore. And they herded all those people in the drugstore. They had the fire facing out. He says it was such that they even had to run in and get fire extinguishers off the shelves
to do spot fires.
And they successfully defended that drugstore and the people that were in it. Wow. And privately, he said to me, our strategy is you get people out. You just get them out. There's no compromise. And he says, we might have to rethink that, because sheltering in place, if it's done right, might be an option. And in that case, it saved a bunch of people's lives. The other thing in response to your question is, when I went to visit the Rim Fire afterwards.
Yosemite one, right?
Well, it's more by McCallamy Hill. Right. In Calaveras County, and they said it had burned through here different times before, and they sort of had a judge, oh, if it crosses that ridge in the distance, we know it's time to start to think. And the fire moved so fast that it blew up people's traditional views.
No time to think.
So in that case, Cal Fire actually, there were certain enclaves that were cut off by the fire early in the first hours of the fire, and they took people and threw them in fire engines and drove them out of the fire. It was the only way to sort of rescue them, and it's sort of a proof of what you're saying about the different fire behavior.
Is there room for like a timber industry to come back and help us do some of this clearing? Does that make sense? I don't know anything about this issue, so tell me I'm a clown if I'm a clown.
I'd never tell you you're a clown. It's more complicated than that. That's the thing. The trouble is sometimes the clearing isn't the thing that's best for timber. And when I was driving into Paradise, the Cal Fire chief who just retired, who is a registered forester, would say, now look at those. You can't get any wood from those, because those are, and he described the thing, and he says, and yet those have to be taken down.
So it's just not right.
It just depends. And some of the places, redwoods happen to be more resilient, and they're the prime desire of a lot of people that harvest trees, but they're more resilient. And so it's not an easy thing based on the science of what every tree is and what the situation is.
I mean, it seems to me just it'd be great if we could find a way to find private partners to help do this. I helped clear my buddy's property up in the mountains, not Tahoe, somewhere out east. And he sold it like, hey, come spend a weekend with me in my cabin. We'll all have fun. We can go to the river, blah, blah, blah. And then, 11 a.m. Saturday morning, out come the chainsaws. I was like, hey, I need you to help me clear this half acre. And I was just like, man, we were out there for like 6 hours. We didn't make a dent. He's like, oh,
But that's one of the reasons that a prescribed fire or a planned burn make sense if it's the right time of the season and the shoulder of the season that you can contain it. That sometimes makes the right thing. Although the rimfire burned so hot that you just went through, and except for a few skeletons of manzanita trees, everything was just taken. And if there was a house in that area, there just might be the cement pad and nothing else. I mean, the fire burned so hot going through there.
We got to get you. We've had you here for a little while. What have we not covered that we should go over while we have them here? Steve Maviglia wants to know where you get your ties from.
Really?
Yeah, really.
I think that was it.
Was that a joke?
I think it was a joke.
Oh.
I don't know what that
no,
was.
No, what it was is when I was in the assembly and I worked with him, I wore mostly Jerry Garcia ties.
Yeah. So,
and you could mostly get them at Nordstrom Rack here for $13.
So my response to that was, and I think you'll appreciate this, my response to his tweet was that that John and Greg Lucas, state librarian, go on shopping trips together in the hate. Because if you know Greg Lucas, he's very much a Jerry Garcia.
There's
kind
a whole
of guy.
Grateful Dead thing, and it's not a coincidence that the Grateful Dead archives are at UC Santa Cruz, and now the Hunter Thompson papers are joining them.
Oh, very cool.
Well, my last thing for John is, I did spend a few months down in SD17, maybe your old assembly district as well, in Pacific Grove.
Yes,
that's where I did alcohol rehab. And it was a life-changing experience for me. Not an easy one, never is. But the people down there are absolutely amazing. It's beautiful. It's, I really thought about moving down there, even though, this is my love, these few square blocks right here. But what a beautiful place that you and John live in, you and John Flores live in. I encourage everybody to get down to the Central Coast whenever they can.
It's gorgeous. And one of the funny things was the League of Cities hadn't met in Santa Cruz County in forever. And it's near the end of the time I was in the legislature. They decided to meet in this place in Santa Cruz. And Tony Cardenas was on the LA City Council, then a former legislator. And he walked up to me and says, "I've never been here before. Do you live somewhere by here? This is amazing." He was in the middle of a redwood forest and you could see the ocean. And I said, now do you understand why we all want to protect the environment? You understand why that's just indigenous to the Central
Coast?
This
kind of comes full circle, John, in that, okay, so you want to keep making that drive to go from there to here?
I'm rather zen about it. And
what's that? Yeah, because there's
2 hours, 20 minutes, slightly above the speed limit, no traffic.
Well, we're going to give you, we're working on 2 hours a week in podcasts. So hopefully we can tickle your ears.
Oh, this is perfect. And the thing is that I grew up in Vallejo, and Sacramento was this sleepy Mississippi River town. It just seemed stifling, nothing going on in the summer. And it is totally different. I have come to love Sacramento. It is really fun. There's a lot going on. I feel like if you have to live in two places, it's the perfect balance. Although when I was in the legislature, I'd pull out of the Capitol some Thursday afternoons. It'd be 109.
Can't wait to get out of town.
Yeah, I'd hit the summit to Santa Cruz. I'd see the fog. I'd cheer out loud, even though I was by myself. And it would drop a half a degree until I was 66 degrees with the fog in my driveway. And it'd be a 43 degree swing in the drive,
Yeah. Before you go, where can folks connect with you? Are you on Twitter? Where can folks connect?
I'm on Facebook.
You're on Facebook. Do you have a page set up for your 2020 campaign?
People want to know, John. LairdForCASenate.com. John Laird for Senate on Facebook.
Okay.
A great closing email that I just got literally from Bill Monning. Whose district John wants to succeed Bill in. Great guy, great senator. He just said, "Thank you for the delivery of the Nooner coffee mug," which John Laird is getting one today, filled with chocolates. So Bill Monning get it. We don't endorse. I don't endorse. But I think you certainly have shown that, you still got it, man. You still got it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for coming on.
It was my pleasure. I look forward sometime to doing it again.
Yep.